Meeting is being recorded.
Okay. Our learning tonight is sponsored by Naomi Belzon in memory of her father, Shmuel Ben Avram, Zichron LeBrach, Alan Greenspan, in memory of his mother, Sarah Bashmuel, Zichron LeBrach, and Michael Levin, in memory of his grandfather, Zev Ben Yitzchak, Zichron LeBrach. I think this is going to be our last year before Ben Azmanim. Ben Azmanim traditionally runs through from Yom Kippur through the end of Sukkot. But insofar as this rabbi also has Shabbos Shuvah Drasha and pastoral issues to deal with, I think we're going to start a little bit early. We'll see. I mean, maybe if in theory we don't cover enough ground, maybe we'll do one more shiur. But we're going to try our best to finish, or at least get as far as we can in the Rechaim piece that we've been studying together tonight. And certainly after Sukkot, we'll get back to our more standard format of doing sugyas together, a whole new set of sugyas and Maseches Gittin. At the outset, a number of them will actually not be get related at all, totally new topics. First paragraph of Maseches Gittin deals with a number of interesting issues that are tangential issues but interesting ones. And then at a certain point, we'll likely skip to the second paragraph, which will get us into some really core Gittin issues. And I'm sure I'll return to this, but when I think Rav Aaron Lichtenstein used to give shiur on Maseches Gittin, he used to start from Daf Yud Zayin. He used to start from, the beginning of the second parak, not the first daf in the second parak. The first daf is a continuation of some of the stuff that we've been discussing. On the first parak, but really the Mishnah on Daf Yud Zayin really kicks off a central discussion of some of the main principles of Maseches Gittin, and we'll likely skip to that point. For now, we continue in this piece, this very fundamental piece in Chidush Rabbeinu Chaim Halevi. Now, I will confess to you that the most fundamental parts of the piece we actually did already. When people reference this piece, usually they are speaking about the part that we've covered. In your source sheets, that part runs from the very beginning, where you see the words Hilchasim Machalitza, through the second paragraph to the paragraph break, where we're going to pick up with the words Vihine Gabe Yod, or Yeod, if you want to be technical about it. So we're getting some technical matters, but really, again, the heart and core of the Rav Chaim we saw tonight, we'll just try again, do our best to run through the remainder of it. Now, there's a brief recap and some brief words of introduction for what we are going to see tonight. In recap, we saw that Rav Chaim, again, I'm not quite, I'm reorganizing what we've seen so far for I guess, clarity. For clarity's sake, it's not the same exact analysis or sequence of analysis that Rav Chaim offered. But what Rav Chaim told us is that broadly speaking in halacha, there are two categories of activities. There are certain things that are ba'im mimela. There's a physical act that has an automatic halachic result. That's it. There's nothing more to be said or done about it. Then there are other halachic activities that are contingent on the da'as, on the intent of the thought processes of the actors in that process. The example that I gave, this is not an example that appears in Rav Chaim, is how the same activity can the same physical act can actually be both can achieve both or fit into both categories depending on context. I gave the example of picking an object up and putting it back down. Shabbos, okay, if there's no Eruv, of course, you pick something up from Rosh Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah, you violated a malacha of Shabbos. It's an automatic result. Now again, you could qualify the example in all sorts of ways. There's a concept in Hilchos Shabbos called Malachas Machshavas that does seem to be contingent on Malacha, on Machshava. But in a basic way, again, without getting too nuanced in terms of the details, for simplicity's sake, you move from one place to another, you've objectively violated Shabbos, and the physical activity itself created a halachic result. The same physical act of picking something up in the context of kinyanim, in the context of acquisitions, is contingent on your intent. If I just pick up your object to look at it because I find it interesting, I haven't acquired it. If I pick it up with intent to be kona, what we call das kona, I have intent to acquire it, then the object can potentially become mine. So obviously with your consent and the like. But you do have these broad categories. Rav Chaim introduced two nafkamina, two practical issues that hinge on which category you are in. One was the question of eidos kiyam adavar. When do you need eidim in order for something to come to effect? He argued that when you're in category one, you require when you're in category one, something that results automatically, you don't need eidim. You don't need eidim for that because it's just a result of a physical activity. And the example of Chaim of that kind of halachic activity is chalitza. He argued that chalitza fits into that category, and therefore, according to the Rambam at least, chalitza does not require eidim. By contrast, if you do require das, if it is contingent on the intent of the parties, you will require eidim. And what is the example of that? The example of that is kiddushin, or for our purposes, gerushin. Kiddushin v'gerushin. That was one nafkamina. The second nafkamina he gave was a katan. If you give a katan instruction, you have a gadol standing right, you have an adult standing right behind them, whispering into their ear what to do, explaining how to go through the motions, will it be effective or will it not? Rav Chaim, the Gemara says that chalitza doesn't work by a katan simply because a katan can't read. A katan is not a bar kriya. Rav Chaim said, what, they can't read? A much more fundamental problem. They don't have das. They don't have das. Well, why are you fixated on the reading point? So Rav Chaim went back to his same yesod. Chalitza is something that's again, it's just a physical activity, creates a halachic result. So as long as I can give the katan instructions on how to do it, then it doesn't matter if they have da'as or not. It doesn't matter if they have proper intent. I just need to give them instructions. If they can't read, then they can't go through the actual procedure. And that becomes the problem. But if they could, then da'as is not really an impediment. It's not really an issue. By contrast, in category two, when it comes to kiddushin, let's say you had a good mesader kiddushin. You have an 11-year-old boy. He whispers to him exactly how to say it. They practice. Harei ha'mikudesh asli, puts the ring on her finger, etc., etc. Does it perfectly. Would that be a good kiddushin? Would still not be a good kiddushin because in that instance he lacks ta'as, and if he lacks ta'as, and for that second category of halachic activity that is contingent on ta'as, if you don't have that ta'as, then you're lacking the basic substance of what halachic activity is all about. So again, the two sweeping categories of halachic activities and two nafkamina that are based on them, including our topic of Eidos L'Kiyum HaDavar. Now, Rav Chaim is now going to get into a much more narrow analysis of a particular area of halacha. So again, one of the beautiful features of the Derech HaLimud of Rav Chaim's analysis is that you have this frequent interplay, and I referenced this in the past, between broad sweeping principles and incisive narrow analysis of particular issues. And you see it very acutely in this piece. We've been dealing with narrow issues pertaining to chalitza. We're going to get into narrow issues pertaining to yud in just a moment. That expose much broader principles in halacha. Again, these two different types of halacha categories and all the nafkamina that apply to them. So we're going to get into a very narrow area of halacha. Before I do that, just parenthetically, I noted two additional nafkamina, potential nafkamina of these issues that were not noted in Rechaim itself, based on a Gemara in Ksubis. That was the issue of Tanai and the issue of Shlichos. Tanai and Shlichos. The Gemara links those two issues. Can I make a condition on a halacha activity? Can I make a condition? Can I pick up the item and put it down and say, oh, I'm only violating Shabbos, I'll t'nai that, it rains tomorrow. Can't do that. You've automatically violated Shabbos. You can't make a t'nai on that kind of halakhic activity. It's an automatic result. Can I pick it up and say, oh, I have da'as to be kona this, or I'm making a kinyan, al manas that, you pay me X, or I pay you X, or whatever the case may be, whatever condition you make? Yes, you can. Can you make a t'nai? Can you make a condition on a kiddushin? Yes, you can. So t'nai might be another nafkamina of that, and shlichus as well, sending a shliach to do something. Can I divorce the physical activity from the halachic result? If it's an area where it's just contingent on the physical maisa, I may not be able to make a shliach. There you have the famous example, davash abagufo. I can't say, put tefillin on your arm and have me in mind, and I'm yotzei the mitzvah. Pick up a lulav and esrog in your hands and have me in mind, and I'm yotzei the mitzvah. It's contingent on the physical activity. But can I make a shliach to perform a kiddushin? I can make a shliach to perform a kiddushin. So that might be another nafkamina. Those are not in Rechaim itself, but two other potential nafkaminas of our principle. Tonight we get into yud. What is yud? Yud is a process. It's described in Parshas Ki Tzeitzei, so we just read about it a few weeks ago, whereby the following happens. If one is kona in Amma Ivriya, one acquires a Jewish maidservant, the Torah says that at a later point, he can choose to make this maidservant into his wife, through a process called yiyud. Now that's an interesting idea, both halakhically and hashkafically. Some would argue that that is actually the real intent of Amma Ivriya. We'll circle back to that perhaps it's really intended to be a source of upward mobility rather than servitude, that it's really a form of marriage rather than just a form of enslavement. But and again, we'll return to the halakhic basis of that in a moment. But that is the concept of yud. You have, again, the abal or an adon. You have a master. You have an amma ivriya, and you have this process of like kind of like a kiddushin, kind of like a marriage that transforms their relationship from master servant into husband and wife. That is the concept of yud. Number one. Number two, yiyud is by definition done on a young woman who is not yet 12 years old. Why by definition? Because once an amma ivriya hits the age of 12 years old, she automatically goes free. So by definition, this kiddushin process, this chuppah, if you will, is happening on a woman who has not yet reached halachic adulthood. Point number two. Point number three. Perhaps the most significant and central question within Yiyud, if you're familiar with the principle of Yiyud, the most critical conceptual question that you need to be aware of is a machlokas in the Gemara Kiddushin as to whether Ma'os Rishonos Konos or Ma'os Rishonos Lav Enam Konos. In other words, here is the question that, that's not the Lashon of the Gemara. Ma'os Rishonos L'Kiddushin Nitnu or Ma'os Rishonos Lav L'Kiddushin Nitnu is the Lashon of the Gemara, is the question of the Gemara. When the Adam makes this purchase of the Amma Ivriya, okay? Were those original monies designated for the Kiddushin? In other words, even at the initial point of purchase, there's this kind of like implicit understanding that the money that he hands over for the purchase of the Amma Ivriya is intended for Kiddushin, or no? Was that the purchase of a servant, totally separate and distinct from the monies that he will later use in order to perform a Kiddushin? Okay? What was Rishonos L'Kiddushin Nitnu or Lav L'Kiddushin Nitnu? Now again, going back to the point I was making before, if you view this entire process as really geared towards marriage, then it makes sense to say Ma'os Rishonos L'Kiddushin Nitnu. It was really an implicit Kiddushin at the very outset, at the very initial stages. So it's rooted, the idea that Amma Ivriya is more than just servitude is already rooted in that view. But that is a machlokas in the Gemara. And that's going to be a critical point for us as well. That covers the critical background. There was one other point that I wanted to make. I will leave it at that. If the other point comes to me,
well. Does it make any difference if the year is being done by the master? It can also be done by
the son. So that's another interesting question. Like, what is the relationship between the yud of the Adon and the yud of Beno? But for our purposes, that's not going to be, again, we were learning the latter half of the first parak of Kiddushin. That would be an interesting question for us. It's not going to impact our analysis so much.
Is she retroactively interested?
Good. We'll get into that. Yes. The answer is yes. And that's going to be an important point for our analysis. The final point I was going to make is the following. This is more of a parenthetical point, but it's an interesting one, a noteworthy one. A husband towards his wife has three halachic obligations. What do we call them? She'er kesos ve'ona. Major machlokas as to whether they're all de'oraisa, some are de'oraisa, one is de'oraisa, two are de'oraisa, whatever. You have these three halachic obligations that a man has towards his wife. Where does the Torah mention that obligation? It's in this context. In the context of Yiyud, the Torah says, she'er kesos ve'ona salo yigra. It's in that context that the Torah mentions she'er kesos ve'ona. A very funny context to be mentioning those chiyuv, right? So there are different approaches that are developed. I'll just share with you two of them. Number one, Rav Hirsch notes this as a general meta principle in Torah, that very often the Torah will mention an obligation in a circumstance where you would have a hava amina that it would not apply. Where you might think that it wouldn't apply, there specifically the Torah tells you that you're obligated. So in this case, you think to yourself, oh, maybe it's not a full marriage, maybe it's like not to the full extent of an ordinary kiddushin. The Torah says, no, she'irak susav onasol yigram. There are countless examples of this. Where does the obligation to bury someone come from? Where does the term mention it? Yeah. Okay, so Yaakov buries in the context of where? Where they bury Yaakov?
Yes.
That's not where the obligation comes from. Avraham buries Sarah too. Where does the tzivui happen? Where does the command happen? It happens in the context of Chayav Emisos Beis Din. Chayav Emisos Beis Din. The Torah says, Kavor Tik Beru Bayom Ahu, right? Bury the guy that day. Jesus based him like that. That's really when Nebuch, somebody's burying a loved one. The paradigm we're using is this shmo who decided to engage in avodah zarah, right, and deserve capital punishment. So once again, if ever you'd think there was an instance where you didn't need to respect someone's basic tzelem elokim, someone's basic divine image, and don't need to bury them, it would be there. The Torah dafka there says bury, and that's the source of the obligation to bury. Where's the isser to hit someone? You're not allowed to beat somebody up. Where's the isser on physical assault? Where does that appear? Sorry?
Eved.
Not Eved. Malchus Beis Din. Right? The Gemara says that Arba Im Yakenu, Lo Yosef, hit him 40 times, or the Torah Shabbat Pes is 39 times, and don't add more. And that's the source of the obligation. So again, a very funny context. So again, if ever you think you give the guy an extra makkah, we're not going to have Rachmanos on this guy who did an Aveira. The Torah says there. The source, according to the Ramban, about the prohibition of gaiva comes from the mitzvahs that we have by a melech, limiting a melech's riches. riches and wives and horses. That's the Ramban says, that's where you learn that you can't be a Baal Gaiva. If a king can't be a Baal Gaiva, you can't either. So that's just an interesting meta principle that exists in the halacha. Alternately, the fact that She'er Ksus and Ona appears in this context is yet again perhaps another indication that the whole institution of Ama Ivriya is really geared towards Ishus rather than Achdus. So just a parenthetical point, but I think a worthwhile one. Okay, with that, let us jump back into the holy words of Rabbeinu Chaim Halevi. We're picking up on the second paragraph with the second column, the paragraph that begins with the word Vihine. Vihine Gaba Yiyud. In the context of Yiyud, in the context of this marriage to an Amma Ivriya, Tana B'Kiddushin Daf Yates Amad Beis, we have a Gemara Kiddushin on Daf Yates Amad Beis, Ketzad Mitzvahs Yiyud. How does Mitzvahs Yiyud work? Omer La Bifnei Shnayim Harayat Mekudashas. He says to her, what are the keywords for us? Bifnei Shnayim, in front of two Edim Harayat Mekudashas, third line. Behind him Yishum Devalo Edim Lo Have Kiddushin Klal. The reason why it says Bifnei Shnayim, the reason why it says you have to do it in front of two witnesses, is because without those two witnesses, you will not have any Kiddushin. Ukechol, Kiddushin, fourth line to Alma. Like any other Kiddushin, you need two witnesses present. The Kasha, and Rav Chaim says, I have a problem with this. The Gemara also says that you need her consent for a Yiyud. You can't institute this marriage against the consent of this young woman. Because, this opinion maintains, the original money that was given to her father was not for the purposes of Kiddushin, therefore you need her consent. Or we have a special Xeris HaKasov to tell us that we need her consent. So whether it's based on Xeris HaKasov or the view, Maos Rishon Slav, the Kiddushin Nitnu, you need her consent. What's her kind of Kasha going to be? Put together two facts. You need her consent. She's a katana. V'harei amah ivriya hi katana. What do you mean she's a katana? I just got finished telling you that this whole notion of eidos and this question of katan are interrelated, that I can only have eidos when you need das, and I need a gadol when you need das. So how can I have eidos on the das of this katana? And how do I know that she's a katana? Next line, we're now, how many lines down in the paragraph? Seven lines down. This imane gadlos harei yotzeis kfar lacheiros. I know that she's a katana because once she hits 12 years old, she's no longer an amah ivriya. According to this whole analysis that we conducted for the Rambam that says you can't have Eidos L'Kiyum Adavar on a Katan by Chalitza, right, or by Kiddushin, Imkain, not by Chalitza, by Kiddushin, Imkain, Eich Mahanu Hacha Eidim Kivan Hikatana, so how can the Eidim work in this context if indeed she is a Katana? So based on the principles that Rav Chaim elucidated until now, he runs into a problem with this instance of Yiyud. Again, just I know I'm at the risk of sounding like a broken record. He has these broad principles, but whenever you have a broad principle, it needs to work in every single case. I mentioned before we studied this Rav Chaim, that Rav Chaim was sometimes almost disparagingly called chemist. He almost employed a scientific method. When you have a theory in halacha, it needs to work. And now he's coming up with an experiment that proves a counterexample, and he needs to answer it. Now he's going to offer an answer based on narrow principles within Yiyud, but again, worthwhile for us to understand if we are trying to understand this again, very critical piece in Rav Chaim's work. Underline. Now, Pashut Bezeh, what is the answer? Tibiyud etzam hakidushin na'asa al yadeha. He says, really, really, in Yiyud, the Kiddushin is being done by the father, not by this young woman. But Abba gab the darshinon me'asher lo ye'adah tibiyinon da'aka midaita. Even though the Torah Baal Peh teaches us that I do need her consent, who to have exeris akasov de below daita lo have a yiyud of maisa kiddushin klal. That is a gezeras hakasov. That is exeris akasov. That the pasuk teaches me that I need her intent. We're going to return to that point and unpack it in just a moment. Below kamo b'sharei kiddushin de ikar hakiddushin talui b'daita. And it's not like other acts of kiddushin where her das, as Rechaim has been saying all along, is the primary engine behind the kiddushin. Uvidaita hu dena'asa hakiddushin. And in most cases, it is her da'as through which the Kiddushin is performed. That is not what is going on here. Let's continue for a moment. And again, I'll return back to this to try to elucidate some of the ideas he's presenting here. Could the Chazina de Lamanda Amar Maus or Rishonus the Kiddushin Nitnu? As we see that the opinion that maintains that the first monies were given for Kiddushin, the initial point of purchase of the Amma Ivriya was actually intended for Kiddushin, two lines up from the bottom. This is your point, Steve. Let's say before you have point T1, Reuven purchases an Amma Ivriya. T2, she goes off and accepts Kiddushin from somebody else. T3, Reuven performs Yiyud. So, retroactively, was the first Kiddushin good or no? So Rav Chaim says, Im halcha v'neskacha la'acher kodem Yiyud, hatani b'kiddushin daf yitesem u'beiz, te'emrata l'ya'ed me'ya'ed, u'batlu kiddushin ha'acher. That if he goes and does Yiyud, even though somebody else did a Kiddushin in the meantime, it is chal retroactively from the initial point of purchase, and the second Kiddushin was no good. Top. Presumably, they accepted it from the father. So let's say the father was accepted another Kiddushin. Presumably. Correct. She would have to be a Ketana, by definition.
Even putting Yiyud aside, you wouldn't need his consent, the master's consent, to that marriage?
That is a good question. I don't know. It's a good question. I didn't think about it. The simple implication of the Gemara is that they would not need his consent. Right. Why not?
Because the father still has.
I guess why, yes. She's not.
Her father still has violence over her.
What?
Her father still has violence over her in some level, at least to extend to her marriage. Maybe the.
Yeah, perhaps. At least as far as Kiddushin is concerned. Well, again, you're making the implicit assumption, Moshe, that we're bringing out here, which is that the first sale of Amma Ivriya was for marriage, right? That's kind of the point that we're bringing out, and that's goofy why the second marriage is going to be batal retroactively. It's going to be nullified retroactively. Sorry, one second, Moshe. What was the final point? Correct, exactly, right. That's right, that's the point. David, what were you saying?
Yeah, I was going to say, why can't you say that the initial domin that he got, that's the money for Kiddushin, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the marriage is retroactive.
That the marriage is retroactive. So that's precisely, precisely the question that's being weighed. In other words, you can say, we're going to get into the language in this next column on the next page. But I guess what you're highlighting, David, is even when you give monies for a marriage, it can work through two ways. One can say, going back to the Tanai question that we were talking about before, Harei HaMekudeshes Li La'achar Shloshim Yom. Somebody can say that. But you could also say, Harei HaMekudeshes Li Me'achshav La'achar Shloshim Yom. And the Chiddush of the Gemara is that Yiyud is like the second paradigm, not the first. That's what the Gemara establishes, that according to the one who holds Ma'oz Rishonus L'Kiddushin Nitnu, it's not just...
He hasn't been treating his wife all along.
Correct. So
he hasn't been intimate with her, he hasn't.
Correct. Correct. So again, it would be like the paradigm. So your point is well taken. In other words, and that's kind of what the Gemara is expressing. In other words, it could have just been Harei HaMekudeshes Li La'achar Shloshim Yom. But the Gemara is saying no, it's Me'achshav U'La'achar Shloshim Yom, which is another paradigm that exists within the world of Tanaim and the world of Kiddushin. Now, presumably in that circumstance as well, you're not acting as husband and wife during that interim period. But it does work retroactively once you hit that critical time. Okay? So Rav Chaim is saying, again, let's just read a few more lines and we'll return to some of this. But Rav Chaim is saying that clearly the act of Kiddushin is not done by this young woman, it is done by her father. That's the critical point for Rav Chaim. Why is that the critical point? Because again, his whole problem is how can you have testimony according to the Rambam on the da'as of the Ketana. His answer is, there is no da'as of the Ketana. Where is the real da'as provided in this whole process? It is provided by her father. That's Rav Chaim's Chiddush. Top of the next column. Do you guys have the top of the next column? Or it's cut off a little bit? What's the first word that you have there? Me'aksha? Okay, so you're missing one line. So I'll read the first line. Umefare sham b'gemara. The Gemara there explains, Hatam step on early. La Omer Laisha. Now you should have the line as well. It's like a man says to a woman, you should be Mekudeshes to me from this point. May Akshav Ula Akhar Shloshim Yom Ula Akhar Yudbez Chodesh Vala Akhar Eser Shanim, whatever he says, it's Chal Lemafraya, it works retroactively. Because so Rav Chaim asks, So Rav Chaim presses the issue further. Again, this gets quite nuanced, but he pushes, you know what, before we go into the Bikasha, let me just unpack one point, and then we'll go further. Methodologically, there's one really critical point that I want to bring out here. And it's, again, it's not a point that's in the Rav Chaim itself, but it's a broader methodological point, and we always try to bring out broader methodological points in this year, so I just want to point it out. You have this Gzeiras HaKasuv, Asher Lo Ye'ada, which teaches me that you need, what? The Da'as of this Ketan. Okay? You have a Pasuk that teaches me that you need her Da'as. Whenever you have a Gzeiras HaKasuv like this, you can take the Gzeiras HaKasuv in one of two ways. And you'll see it happening in both cases. Let's say we're weighing this conceptual question as to whether she is the one who's actually doing this marriage or her father is. And now we have this piece of evidence that says we need her Da'as. That would naturally lead us to the conclusion that who's the actor here, her or the father, that she is the actor. So one can say, oh, this Gzeiras HaKasuv is proof that she is the actor and the halacha is reflected of that broader conceptual reality. That's one way to understand the Gzeiras HaKasuv. Alternately, one can say, again, you could take the same words and say, no, why do I need a Gzeiras HaKasuv to teach me this? I need a Gzeiras HaKasuv to teach me this because it's Nitazoi. In other words, because really the father is the one who's doing it, and that's why the pasuk needs to swoop in and tell me that I need her Da'as. So in other words, is the pasuk teaching me the rule? Or I say the whole reason why I need the pasuk is because it's teaching me an exception to the broader conceptual principle. And the truth is, Gzeiras HaKasuv can indeed work either way. You do find instances of both. Here Rav Chaim is saying, the pasuk teaches me that I need her Da'as. And you might think that means that she's actually the primary actor in the Yiyud. And Rav Chaim says, no, it's really just the Gzeiras HaKasuv that you need her Da'as. The pasuk tells you that you need her Da'as, but really, the father is the one who's active here. Now, again, it sounds facetious, but that is indeed how Gzeiras HaKasuv sometimes work. So whenever you're dealing with Gzeiras HaKasuv, you need to approach it with care for that reason. You need to know, it's hard to know exactly when it's operating in one way or the other. But when you do have these Gzeiras HaKasuv, and again, this comes up all the time, and we may have had instances of it in the past, I can't recall any of them offhand, in Shavuos and Gittin, I'll give it some thought to see if we... I'm sorry? Okay, again, well, that gets into a famous Hutra the Chuya question. So maybe, and it also depends on which limud you use. The Gemara in Shabbos quotes a number of limudim there. Does the limud come from Psukim Lagabe Milo or Psukim Lagabe Shabbos? That's an important question too. In the end, we adopt the Gzeiras HaKasuv Vayom Hashmini Mol Basar Lozo. So yeah, there are countless examples of this. As we learn together, we'll continue to see instances of it, and I'll try to be keen on pointing it out. But it's just an important methodological point that I wanted to bring out from the Rav Chaim. Fine. Now let's go further. Now he really gets into the weeds here. We're going to start from the word Vikasha, which for you is on the first line of the third paragraph. Vikasha. And I still have a problem with this. Dareakati lo na'as is eshes ish lemafreya. Even if you want to say that Yud works retroactively, at the point when Shimon's Kiddushin happened, it had not yet been triggered retroactively. Okay, so we're getting into a bit of like a time question here. This is almost like kind of mind-bending sci-fi movie, right? But his point is, again, let's say at 12 o'clock, he purchased the Amma Ivria. At 1 o'clock, Shimon does a Kiddushin. At 2 o'clock, Reuven does the Yud retroactively. Let's just work with that time frame. 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. So Rav Chaim says at 1 o'clock, when person B, when the outsider, when Shimon does the Kiddushin, at that point, the Yud had not yet been triggered retroactively. So at that point, at least, we should say the Kiddushin works. Third line, Va'amailo tafsi ba, Kiddushin. Why didn't the Kiddushin work? Va'ainza doma lemay achshav dena'asis eshes ishtam afreya. It shouldn't be similar to may achshav where she's made an eshes ishtam afreya. Elavadai to hamiha de beyiud shuv ein hakidushin gomra elamidas ha'adon l'chud. But rather, the reason for this is because with yiud, really the only das is coming from the adon himself, not from this amma, not from the young woman. Kain l'man de amar ma'os harishonus l'kidushin nitnu de nasa ma'isa hakidushin l'inyin zeh she'ein hayiud talo yishuv b'dayta. Therefore, according to the Man Amar, who maintains Ma'az Rishon is the Kiddushin Nitnu, that the original point of purchase was the Maisa Kiddushin, her Das is no longer relevant at all. It's fully contingent on the Adon. Al Kain Ahanya Zos, Gamla Inyan Zeh, She'ena Yechola Lakabel Od Kiddushin Me'acher. Therefore, she is prevented from doing a Kiddushin with anyone else. Lo Ayyadei Asma, Lo Ayyadei Abiha, not through her own activity or her father's. V'damia Zos Lame'aksha Bechada Milsa. Therefore, the kiddushin is only talui on his das. The yud therefore works on mafreya. So again, without getting to all the weeds here, his point is the following: even if you want to say that the kiddushin works retroactively, you still have a bit of a time paradox. At point 12, he purchases the amma. At point 1, Shimon does a kiddushin. So what is her status at 1:30? That's Rav Chaim's question. At 12 o'clock, she's married to no one. At 2 o'clock, she was retroactively married to Reuven from 12 o'clock. What is her status at 1:30 is what Rav Chaim is asking.
How did she get married at 1:30?
Let's say she accepted Kiddushin from Shimon.
She
or that's what I was pointing out before. Let's say her father. He or Aviah, as Rav Chaim says. That was the question that Ed was asking before, and I think it's a good question, but evidently the assumption of the Gemara is yes. And again, I confess that I myself, it is confounding, it is interesting, and I didn't give it sufficient thought, but that does seem to be the assumption. That does seem to be the assumption, right?
Is she in a regular case
where
her father
accepts? No, but in Yud she does. That's why I'm saying it's a Gzeres HaKasav, that she requires Das, but it's not indicative of the process of Yud being different. But yes, correct. In an ordinary circumstance, it does not need her das. Now, the father is chayav to receive her das for a separate reason, because of what mitzvah? You have to l'reicha kamocha. It's actually one of the instances where the Gemara derives a halacha based on you have to l'reicha kamocha. But many of the instances where the Gemara derives an actual narrow mitzvah based on you have to l'reicha kamocha, it's not what we would think. It's not, you know, being nice and sharing your candies and, you know, that's certainly true. You know, Hillel tells us you shouldn't do to others what you wouldn't want to be done to yourself. But the Gemara also has all sorts of other interesting mitzvos learned based on behalf of L'Reicha Kamocha. Again, just another parenthetical one, which kind of speaks to some of the things we were talking about before. How does Beis Din kill someone? Gemara says, Bror lo misa yafet. Gemara says that Beis Din should be obligated to make sure that someone has A, a painless death, and B, a dignified death. When they push the guy off the cliff, it shouldn't be too low, because that would be very painful, and it shouldn't be too high, so that his body is dismembered, and that would be undignified. Why? What's the source for that? Okay, so it's interesting. So another instance that you have in the Gemara Kiddushin, Daf Mem Aleph, at the very beginning of the second parak, is, I'm not remembering the exact lashon of the Gemara, but it's something like, La'olam lo yasi isha Adam Isha Ad Shirena, or something like that. That's that you should marry until you see your prospective wife. But the Gemara there also says that you should not marry off your daughter until she can say Rotza Ani, until she expresses her will to do it. So that's a separate halacha, Rabbi. That's a mitzvah of the father in terms of behalf of the Kamocha. In terms of the Kiddushin itself, you would not require her daughter, strictly speaking.
It almost makes it seem like the Baal, he had an optionality at 12 o'clock. Like, it's almost as if it's in his choice to say,
correct,
as at 12 o'clock, if I want to, then it's my choice. So basically, at 1 o'clock, she had that option was taken away from Shimon. He never even had that option in the first place.
So that's kind of the point that Rav Chaim is raising. In other words, Rav Chaim is saying this. So what is her status at 1:30? So the Gemara tells us, at 1:30, she's not really married to Shimon. Chaim says, that doesn't make sense. I get why after 2 o'clock she wasn't married to Shimon, but why is she not married to Shimon at 1:30? So his point is, this is another proof that really the initial act of purchase is the Kiddushin itself, really at that moment with this later trigger. But it's not even like, again, a retroactive Kiddushin that is only Chal at 2 o'clock retroactively. At 12 o'clock, a Kiddushin is pseudo in place, is partially in place, to the point that she is stripped of her right to actually go and accept Kiddushin for anyone else. Her father is stripped of the right to go accept Kiddushin for anyone else. And therefore, again, that's just an extension of Rav Chaim's initial assertion that really who is activating the Kiddushin, not this young woman herself, but her father, well, the Adon for sure, but her father at the initial point of purchase. So again, like I said, it really gets in the weeds here, but yeah.
If you have a situation, for example, so a person has a status of being a Yavama, and she can get out of it with Chalitza, but until that happens, she's bound to the Yavam. So you have, the father has bound her to her Adon, so she has that status. It doesn't seem more complicated than that, is it?
Well, I mean, again, well, I'd say two things. Number one, even that is a chiddush. Even if you want to formulate it in those simple, relatively straightforward and simple terms, it's a chiddush that that's what happens. In other words, the whole idea that she is bound to him before the kiddush fully goes into effect is not at all obvious. I could have just said, no, she is his maidservant, but in terms of kiddush, she has no bond to him whatsoever, right? So even if we work within the framework that you're describing, Saul, it's a chiddush to say that that applies to you. Now, the one proviso I would add, the one qualifier I would add is that that construct in the context of Yibum is remarkably complex, right? What you're touching on is the sugya of Zika, what we call Zikas Yibum. Zikas Yibum is a very difficult and complex sugya. Are they somehow married or are they not? If they are married, is it a continuation of the husband's first marriage that's somehow continuing after death? Or is it some kind of new relationship that's been manufactured by the Torah afterwards, right? So Zika is itself a remarkably complex concept. So I wouldn't say, I'd say like it's structurally parallel to Yud. I wouldn't say that it's substantively parallel given all the complexities and unique circumstances of Yud, of Zika's Yibum itself. But I'd say even the structural parallel, that is exactly the Chiddush that Rav Chaim is highlighting. That there is that marriage originally or pseudo marriage originally from the original point of purchase rather than just being put into effect later.
What
if her das, meaning she refused the marriage? Yeah,
if her das, right, she could say no. But her father accepted it retroactively for her.
That's the gzeiras hakasuv. That's the gzeiras hakasuv. Rav Chaim is treating that as a gzeiras hakasuv.
Would she be married to Shimon then?
I'm sorry?
Would she then be married to Shimon?
If there is no yiyud, would she?
Right.
Rav Chaim, I think, is saying no. I think.
He's saying no. He's
saying she's retroactively married to Reuven, but if she refuses the marriage to Reuven, does her marriage to Shimon then go into effect because it wasn't retroactively married to Reuven?
She doesn't have to refuse the marriage.
Is she even available?
She doesn't. Hold on one second. Oh, no, wait. Hold on. No, but I know Jackie. You also had your hand up. Let Jackie get his question in. Also, Jackie, go ahead. This. Robbie's question is the following. Let's say you purchase an Amud Ivriya. She's 10 years old. 2 years go by. You don't do Yiyud. She goes free. Is she now Mikudeshes to Shimon, who did a Kiddushin when she was 11 years old?
Because he didn't trigger the option. The other didn't trigger the option, so she's
so yes. Presumably it should be a good Kiddushin because he didn't trigger the option. But again, this gets us into the same time. Chaim's whole point, right, is that he took it out of her hands and the hands of her father, and it was purely.
Wasn't in her power to do anything. She was a
child. Let's say the father. Let's say the father, Jackie.
The father did.
Say the father.
He has a last
I think in that circumstance, Shimon's Kiddushin would be Chal. Would be Chal. Now, does that contradict what Chaim is saying somehow? Obviously not. The question is, why not?
Because he has an option, the other. And the option is from the age of 10 to the age of 12, I hold the power to marry you should I so choose. If he did not choose, if he did not exercise the option, then, and she gets married at age 11, then after she gets the age of 12, that marriage should be Lemafreya, should hold because he didn't trigger the option. That was his only right. It was sort of separating this into.
It's almost as if the triggering of the option redefines what the initial purchase. This is the whenever you get into limafreya issues, right? You get into these complications. There's a classic hakira in the world of yeshivos. When we say limafreya, do we mean limafreya limafreya or mikanu lahaba limafreya? That's like an actual classic hakira, which just highlights how confusing time these notions of time can be for us who experience time in linear fashion. For the Ribono Shel Olam, I'm sure these all make perfect sense, but it's a little harder for us. So when it comes to the Mafreya, I think, Ed, what you're articulating is correct. It's almost as if his exercising of the option reframes what the initial transaction was. Was it one of servitude or was it one of ishus? It's almost as if going through with the yiyud actually redefines what it was. I think that sounds correct to me.
Why should the father have the right to intervene with Shimon to create the new?
Why not?
Because he's already created the situation with Reuven by selling her as.
Yeah. But if that was only as an Amal Ivriya and not for Kiddushin.
No, but that's not what I'm trying to say. What I'm saying is it's Kiddushin.
That's the point that Robbie's bringing out. Even with this stronger formulation of Rav Chaim, it's obviously predicated upon going through with the Yiyu. That's where it gets, again, counterintuitive. In other words, even Rav Chaim would agree, he's only talking about a case where the Adon actually does Yiyud, not a case where he doesn't exercise the option. So when he says it's an actual Kiddushin at the outset, it's almost a Kiddushin predicated upon a trigger. And once you have that trigger, it was a real Kiddushin at the outset. It's
But the father soul is exercising, like, it's the bundle of options. He's saying, okay, the Adon has the option to pull the trigger on the marriage anytime between age 10 and age 12. And if he doesn't, then the father's hedging his bets. The father left to Shimon and saying, hey, Shimon, if he doesn't, I mean, effectively what he's saying, because the father doesn't say it, if you know, Reuven doesn't pull the trigger, then at the age of 12, she becomes yours. Now, so is there some concept of Rabbi Yehuda's coming in at age 11?
I'm sorry?
Except he's doing it at age 11. I hear what you're saying, but at age 11, so he's still got another year. I would see that is if he pulls the trigger at 1 minute before she's 12, so that she comes, so that essentially simultaneously, she comes out of Abdus into marriage. But when she does it a year beforehand, that's how you get into this sticky floating.
Right, correct, exactly. That's right. That's precisely the problem. That's precisely the scenario.
But right, so you're saying that, you know, the father's hedging the bet, so that she comes out at 12, she comes out at 12 as married. But he's marrying her at 11.
Who's he? We got to stop using he. Adon or Acher, yeah. The other guy. By the way, Ed, Moshe, Ed. Now you're least again. Forget about Reuben and Shimon, but okay. But Jackie, what were you going to ask? You were going to add something? Yeah. If you're what?
In the 130 example.
Yeah. What's her status at 130? Yeah.
The Maschia died. Who do they go to? Because as an Allah, the Masri Daim go to the father. As an Isha, the Masri Daim go to the Baal. So over here, there's a fundamental.
It's inconceivable that the Masri Daim would go to the Baal. It doesn't make any sense, right?
It doesn't make sense that she could be married.
If she's married, who's the Baal?
An Eved Ivri could be married when he's an Eved.
If she's considered married at 130 to Shimon. She's not married until 2 o'clock.
No. He's saying that again. Well, no. The whole point is, let's say he doesn't exercise the yield and the kiddushin goes through at 1:30. Then your question is, who would receive the ma'aseh adayim? It's inconceivable that the answer is the husband. It must be the other. No. It doesn't make sense that it would go to the Baal. It has to be the other. The question is why. Okay. Here's what I'm going to say. Chevrot is 10 o'clock. I will, Bli Neder, be spending a little more time on this Rav Chaim over the course of this week, and depending on how much I understand, will determine whether we have Shir next week or not. David, go ahead. Yeah. We'll talk after. Yeah. Hold on one second. Let me just end the recording.